Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Pete and I are off down the canal having a walk as normal, as we often do when we're recording these things, because walking and talking just feels an awful lot better than sitting in a room. There's a bit more sort of energy and liveliness to it, we feel. So, this is going to be episode 12 of our Lao Tzu series, and today we're going to be dealing with chapters 18, 19 and 20. So, as usual, we're going to read out each chapter and then have a chat about what we think is going on about. Okay, so here's chapter 18.
When the great Tao is lost sight of, then people have to try to be kind and gentle. They try to compensate by being clever, but this only breeds hypocrisy and sleight of hand. When families fall out, relationships sour into useless formality. When the nation is misled and in chaos, ministers mouth empty promises. Sounds very familiar.
Yeah. I find this one of the more approachable ones. Sometimes you, when we first read over these, it's like, look at it and think, what? What's he going after? I have to really think about it. But this one seems a lot more plain and obvious to me.
Yes, you're right. It is very plain and obvious. And some of the other chapters are sort of quite opaque and you have to work.
Yeah.
We're reaching a point now where it really is obvious that there's quite a lot of repetition, that themes are coming and going and returning. And there's another 50 chapters to go. So there's going to be a fair bit of this. So.
Yeah. But we were talking yesterday, where we were like, why we thought this, why he was repeating and revisiting the same theme from a slightly different perspective often, and how, although you could get a bit, he's just repeating himself, but actually it's actually quite useful and he's doing it for a reason.
Absolutely, it's a sound method, I believe.
Yeah.
And Lao Tzu is a perspectivist. He thinks that if we want to understand something, we look at it from many angles. And the themes that we've got so far, we've got the character of the sage, and the character of ideal government, as well as a sense of the way the universe and nature and the cosmos and human beings work, with his mysticism of the Tao, and the Tao understood as something which is ineffable. So there's a whole kind of consideration of ineffability and language going on here as well. So we've got these kind of four or five themes just woven in and out, but each time it comes around to a different angle. We look at it from the south, and then he moves around a few degrees to the southeast and has another look. And over time, as you read through, it builds up. It builds a picture.
Yeah.
He's like somebody working on a canvas. And he's giving us a rough sketch at the beginning, just with a bit of light pencil. Now he's filling in the areas and putting in the modelling. And he's going over, he'll do a bit down the left-hand corner and come up to the top.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to the end, you've got this complete picture.
It's such a lovely way to describe it. That's really nice.
Yeah. So, bear with us on that.
Yeah.
So, in this chapter, which is chapter 18, we've got Lao Tzu once again positing that there is a kind of a natural spontaneity to a human being, which is primordial to being human. It's like it's a given. It's a given rather than something we cultivate. Which, however, we can become out of focus with. It's not as though that thing goes away, that alignment with the Tao goes away, because you'd be dead. But what it is that you can, as he puts it, lose sight of it. What I like to think of it as kind of a losing focus with this primordial matter of one's being alive. And let's say he's talking about that innocency of being as well. And I say he's rather more like Rousseau than Hobbes in this respect, you know, as a political thinker. He thinks there's something inherently good in human beings, if you can put it very crudely. But civilization, in a sense, screws that up. So he's going on in the three chapters that we're about to consider, to bewail the effects of civilization. There's the idea that we've become too sophisticated, too clever, too smart, and therefore perhaps a bit devious. He's not very keen on that, you know. He's not proposing any kind of Machiavellian scenarios at all. So, okay, he puts it very plainly there, right at the beginning. You know, when the great Dev is lost sight of, then people have to try to be kind and gentle.
Yeah, try is the very key word.
You have to try. Yeah.
And then he used the word try in the second bit there.
They try to compensate by being clever, but this only breeds hypocrisy and sleight of hand. I think it's try. So he's saying a thing.
It becomes artificial rather than just a natural way of being.
I mean, I keep saying to people that you can't cultivate the yoga being state, you know, which is really the alignment with the Tao is just another set of words for exactly that same thing. You cannot cultivate it. And since you've already got it, why try to cultivate it? The only thing that's gone wrong here is that you've lost sight of it, which is rather different. It's still there, but you've lost sight of it. And of course, when this happens on a kind of mass cultural level, people do become devious, you know. And our whole economy is based on deviousness, from what I can say. You know, all the thing of like FUD and FOMO and pump and dump in the various financial markets. These are all just manipulation at every turn, you know.
Yeah.
The whole advertising industry.
Morning.
The whole industry giving over to just deceiving people. And in a not particularly benevolent way. So, and okay, we all think we would like people to be kind and gentle. Yeah. And,
well, it would be nice.
Yeah, unless you're one of these nutters that celebrates like going into schools and shooting dozens of kids, you know, and and thinking that the solution to that is to just arm everybody, so everybody's ready to have a shootout at a moment's notice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And finding some kind of devious logic to celebrate that kind of bullshit. I mean, kindness and gentleness are a desiderata to anybody who's sane. But nevertheless, once we start trying, we can't in a sense then produce kindness and gentleness. We can produce its facsimile. We can perhaps blackmail people into behaving on the surface in kind and gentle ways. I mean, this is the same conundrum that we've talked about before, isn't it? When we've said things like, well, you can't force yourself to love, either you do or you don't.
Yeah.
And this is what he's getting at, you know. He's bewailing it, you know. He's a utopian who imagines a state of nature in which people are natural and simple. We have to be aware of that, you know, this whole discussions acting is being had on a plane of utopian thinking. I mean, he goes on, I mean, the other bad effect of losing this kind of natural spontaneity and having to try to be kind and gentle is that when families do fall out, relationships sour into useless formality. Of course, that's what we do. We're kind of polite and cold, you know, and the world's full of this stuff. And just go and watch any box set on Amazon or Netflix or Google Play or whatever, and that's what you'll see. There's just thousands of dramas about this strain, because it makes some kind of drama, you know.
Yeah.
The people are being polite, but really, underneath, there's this sourness and resentment and all the rest of the bullshit. And this is all from losing sight of the great Tao. Remember, the great Tao is this ultimate principle of movement and change that is, in a sense, powering everything, from the galaxies right the way down to our brain cells with our social organisation and all the rest of it. Then the last bit. When the nation is misled and in chaos, ministers may have empty promises. Well,
yeah. Say no more.
Say no more. And I don't know what country you're listening to this in, but certainly here in the UK, that is it. They're just... Rome burns and they're kind of fiddling and squabbling. So, there we have it. And Lecce's diagnosis is too much sophistication in a sense, and we'll come to that in the other chapters. But we have to be a bit careful there. We have to be a bit careful of getting into some kind of anti-intellectualism or some anti-thought ideas, or into some kind of celebrations of ignorance.
Yeah.
And we have to kind of work around the hyperbole of Lecce's way of presenting himself. But certainly, his diagnosis, his loss of contact with this deeper part of ourselves and this deeper part of our world and our cosmos. And it's not like we don't have that contact, because it's that contact which supports life itself. But we've lost sight of it. As the man puts it, we've lost sight of it. It's not like there's anything wrong with the universe, but we're given the situation, we can lose sight of it. And it's a part of the drama that we lose sight of it. Maybe when we realise we've lost sight of it, then there might be some kind of movement. But all that is a part of the drama, and we realise that it's a part of the drama of existence.
So do you want to mention the koan of simplicity there?
Okay, this is a good point to mention it, and... It's something that comes out in the next two chapters, which we're going to move on to in a moment. The koan of simplicity is my name for the way in which it is impossible to cultivate simplicity and the kind of spontaneity of consciousness and action that Lao Tzu celebrates and believes is a kind of a cure for the ills of his day, which are ills that we're seeing very, very plainly in our own society now in the 21st century West. And that is the koan, is if you try and... you see the analysis and you agree with it, and it all makes sense. But you then try to be simple. In trying to be simple, you stop being simple. And this is analogous to Patanjali's koan, which is the koan of effort.
Good morning.
You try to be quiet, and the trying to be quiet through force is itself noise. So there's always... I would put it to you that every spiritual teacher with any juice is presenting us with a koan of this type. Self-referential, self-defeating position that we find ourselves in. When we try and wrestle with the meaning of human life, with the questions of who am I, what am I, where am I going, all this big stuff, that we always hit a koan. And Lao Tzu's koan is the koan of simplicity. Because alignment with the Tao is essentially simple. You know, it's like the yoga being, so it has this kind of pristine simplicity to it. Whilst at the same time containing the whole kind of swirling fractal mandala of existence, there's nevertheless this pristine unity to it, yeah. So that's the koan of simplicity, and we'll see it again and again and again. And I suppose my pointer, if it's to mean anything about how to deal with that, is, well, you do have to deal with it yourself. I mean, it's your struggle. But I would say to you, you can't cultivate it. The harder you try, the more you produce a bland and confusing complexity. Because the act of trying is itself a defeat of simplicity. But you can settle into it, this alignment with the Tao. This losing sight of the Tao. We can just allow the Tao to come back into sight, because it's nothing other than our consciousness, our life. It's nothing other than the movement of things within us and around us. And we can do that even though it is a kind of non-doing. And of course the Taoists are great non-doers. Their thing is settle in, settle down into it. Just allow yourself to be what you are, in a sense. That sounds horribly New Age, but there you go. And this is my pointer, if you're going to take any notice of an idiot like me. And this is what I'd like to point out, that we can settle into it. But certainly don't try too hard, because that makes it all much more desperate, I would say.
Okay, so let's move on to chapter 19.
Okay. If the sage could abandon his wisdom and skill, then everyone would be 100 times better off. If the sage could let go of holding the scales, then everyone would flow in the web of harmony. And if the sage can give up looking to gain, then there will be no theft or exploitation. Now, while these three things are important, they are not enough. The people themselves need to learn simplicity. They shouldn't need to know more than they do, and should have as few things as possible.
This is one of those ones where you think, what the hell was he on when he wrote that one? Because you kind of look at the first line there and you think, what?
Super tricky. What? Do you say yes? What? What the hell's he on about? I mean, even the sage has to abandon wisdom and skill, but don't we imagine the sage to be someone with great wisdom and skill who can lead us? But Lao Tzu's saying, no, too sophisticated. The tower's already been lost sight of, already.
Yeah.
Wisdom.
Yeah, because
skill, you know. But he's saying that, but if the sage, who is, remember this, the sage leader, the sage gives up all that, and he's just much, much more intuitive, much more in tune with the flow of things, much less inclined to interfere, I think this is fairly important, then everybody's better off. You need to remember there's a certain hyperbole going on here, you know. This is Lao Tzu's method of presentation. It's to use a fair degree of hyperbole. Obviously, no one is going to rule a community or a society or lead a community or a society or a group in or a community without some kind of skill, some statecraft and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, if the devil's lost sight of, that statecraft will go amiss, and of course we do see it every day. You know, we are living in the midst of all these warnings coming true. So he goes on. If the sage could let go of holding the scales, and what does he mean here by scales? Well, he's talking about we're familiar with like the scales of justice and trying to bring balance and so forth. All right.
Hi.
But he's saying that there would be harmony if the sage didn't again try to be too manipulative. That the harmony is already implicit within existence itself, and that is what we should be availing ourselves of, rather than artifactual and human ideas of justice and evaluation and so forth. Again, if the sage can give up looking for gain, there will be no theft or exploitation. I mean, in other translations, he says, "Well, if nobody's got anything, there will be no thieves." You know, and he says, if there are no laws, there will be no crime.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so. Well, if there's nothing to pinch, how can there be thieves, you know?
Well, true.
And if there are no laws to break, how can there be crime?
So we're all going to be starving to death at the same time.
Well, again, this thing is, it's hyperbole, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's hyperbole. He's drawing out how the Tao has been lost sight of, to use his words in the previous chapter. But this is the key thing. Now, we've got all this stuff about the quality of the sage, the actual nature and character of the sage, and then we've had chapters and chapters on this. We've probably had to speak about this in every podcast. But now Lao Tzu is saying, well, the people themselves need to learn the same simplicity as the sage. So here we've got a new idea here, the sage's exemplar. And I think this is what saves Lao Tzu from being the kind of fascist that Plato was, or at least seemed to be. Now, in Plato's Republic, which might be Plato's utopia, on the other hand, it could be a dystopian warning, and it's not that clear from the text. But basically, this is a society that's ruled by an elite who are educated. Nobody else is educated except in the most basic way. And the people are kept in the dark. Said that the job of rulers is to tell noble lies to the populace in order to have an ordered and efficient society. Sounds kind of familiar, you know. What's a modern adage is, how to run a business where you employ a lot of workers. Well, treat them like mushrooms. Keep them in the dark and feed them on bullshit. And this is the idea put forward in the Republic, and it is kind of proto-fascist society, basically, the Republic. But Lao Tzu, you could think easily, couldn't you, that Lao Tzu is trying the same thing here. Because he's recommending ignorance. You know, it's better if the people don't know anything. You know, he says at the end, the people shouldn't know more than they do.
Yeah.
We can get too sophisticated. Too much education turns us into smart Alex. It's superficial. Sophistication can be incredibly superficial. You know, and he's speaking against that kind of superficiality of character. But it could look as though he was recommending ignorance.
Yeah.
That he was pushing the same line as Plato. That, well, okay, you know, just keep everybody in the dark. And then, you know, if we discourage questioning, they won't ask any awkward questions and keep society ticking over. Mm-hmm. This is basically the fascism. Yeah. And but of course, Lao Tzu is being a bit different here. He's saying that the sage actually is an exemplar for everything. The sage himself is simple. The sage himself is seen through a superficial sophistication of manners, which of course is what the Confucians were trying to put in place. They tried to keep society going in an ordered fashion through rules and very, very elaborate etiquette and all this kind of stuff. And again, we've seen that in modern times. You know, the British Empire was built on the back of those sort of ideas. But actually, Lao Tzu saves himself from that Platonic fascism by telling us that the sage is an exemplar. And the sage himself is simple, as he recommends the people be simple. Now, the other thing he says right at the end here, he says, and also the people should have as few things as possible. And this is a theme that gets elaborated further in the next chapter.
Okay, so saying, let's move on to chapter 20, which is a bit longer than the ones we've been reading out. So we've got little bits of paper here that we've got to print it out on. It's a bit windy today, as you can probably hear on the recording, so they're flapping around a little bit, but here we go. I've got them out.
All right, chapter 20. Listen, give up trying to be so learned and things will be a lot easier. Is there really any difference between a yes and a no said in sincerely? Is there really much of a difference between being angry and pretending not to be? What the people are afraid of, I also need to fear. But what do most people do? They go looking for a good time. They go looking for fool's gold and auspicious signs. Only, you see, I am lazy. And I don't give a damn about fame or money. I am like a child who cannot bring himself to smile. What do the people want? money and things. And yet I find I have nothing, and I don't care. I am as unambitious as any fool. Most people seem to be bright and sharp, and how do I feel? Like a blunted sword. The people are like waves of sea, and I am drifting between them, wherever they are blown. And the people are so busy, but I have nothing to bother about. I am a bumpkin, a lout. I am different, I am strange. I live for the mother. There's a lot
quite
of stuff in there.
I am a bumpkin, a lout. Yeah. I don't give a damn.
Yeah.
It's a strong language from Lao Tzu today.
Yeah, again, he's preaching against basically the sophistication and insincerity and two-faced nature of people the minute they lose sight of the Tao. But he's like a child that's unwilling to smile. You ever try and get a baby to smile and it doesn't want to? You know, they are utterly like truthful and sincere. But when they do, it's like sunshine, you know? And he's like that. You can't sway him with your stories and your presentation of self. I suppose one of the things that goes out the window for Lao Tzu is this whole notion of that you have to present yourself. And these days you have to be your own brand. That self-presentation is all important. But of course it's an act. You know, it's all about the persona, and he's saying, fuck that. Too sophisticated. Actually not real, and at bottom untruthful. And he's kind of right. And I suppose acquiring things, which he's speaking against here, is in the same vein, because things tend to be status symbols, don't they? You know, the big shiny red car is like it's like a fucking phallic symbol and a bit of braggadocio. It kind of says, here's my big red cock, you know. That's what all that's about, isn't it? So, and he sees through all that. I mean, in another translation, I kind of quite like the way the translator put all this. And the translator has Lao Tzu say, I alone am dull and stupid. Everybody else seems like sophisticated.
He feels very grumpy in this chapter.
He's grumpy.
He's
grumpy.
I think he's had an experience with some people and they just really annoyed him.
Well the whole thing. Remember that the guy was leaving the country because he couldn't stand it anymore. He was going on his ox.
Goodbye.
Over the mountains, through the Western Gate to Tibet to live his days out. In a nice dry cave up in the mountains there. Because he'd had enough, he really had enough.
Some days I know how he feels.
Yeah. Well, Nietzsche said, our biggest danger is disgust
at man.
And of course, it sounds like Lao Tzu sort of almost succumbed to it here. But nevertheless, he still cares about the people because he's still trying to tell them. He's still trying to drum some sense into them. So, as for things and possessions in general, this might kind of seem a bit counterintuitive to us. I mean, at the end, I mean, it is hyperbole. Nobody can have nothing, you know. And I don't think there's anything wrong with moderate prosperity, as long as it's not destroying everything to gain it, including our own kind of basic sense, which is what actually a big part of what alignment with the Tao is. Regaining a sight of the Tao is actually a kind of a transcendental common sense. You know, it's not wisdom in any high-flown way. It's a sort of...
I like that, transcendental common sense. I did
steal that, actually. So. but it is a kind of a... It's a kind of wisdom, but not a showy wisdom. And Lao Tzu does tell us in previous chapters how useful the Tao is, and he's talking about a kind of skill and a kind of wisdom. But it's not cleverness, and it's not like a skill that's so sophisticated that it undermines itself. It's something more, I don't know, just earthy again. We always keep using this word earthy, don't we, with respect to Lao Tzu. But as for things in general, and possessions in general, I mean, actually, what he's got to say is very apposite for now. I mean, after all, we are choking on our own excess. And we've got basements and sheds and garages and lofts full of crap.
Yeah.
Which we've used once and are no longer interested in. Do you remember Bill Bryson talking about that when he's looking at all the stuff in his closet, in his
American closets?
Yeah.
Like
things that haven't even been taken out of the box.
Skis and roller skates and
Just got so much disposable income, you just buy stuff.
Yeah.
And of course it's choking us now, you know. And, so you've got toys and fads and unwanted presents. And all of this keeps the toxic, environmentally destructive economy going. Consumerism is the power of it, the powerhouse of it. But the corollaries of this cornucopia are plastic islands in the ocean, aren't they?
Yeah.
Landfill sites, huge landfill sites, toxic landfill sites, and waste and shit as far as the eye can see. But I suppose from our modern point of view, we've got to be a bit careful because simplicity has to be voluntary, otherwise we're heading towards fascism.
Yeah.
And it seems to me one of the things that this brings out that might not be that obvious on the surface, but one of the things that this discourse brings out is that a green fascism is possible. I mean, it could be that an authoritarian regime would be the only way to save the species. Push really came to shove. Mm. And I think we mustn't let things get that far. We really mustn't. And we can see the warning in Lao Tzu's hyperbolic way of presenting our situation to us. It's interesting that even 2,500 years ago, these concerns were there.
I know. I wonder what the red Lambo equivalent of his time was.
It would have been something like
a really fast horse or something, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe a fast horse or a jade hair clip, you know.
Yeah.
There were things like this. Status symbol. Status was very important. It was
it's
a cast.
Amazing, because we kind of see him as like living. So you know, he is like one of the ancients in our consciousness. Yeah. That's how we see him, and yet the stuff that he's talking about. It's so relevant to actually 2018.
Yeah, he's saying like modern life has gone to shit.
Yeah.
Those old guys had it sorted out. You know, the true men of old and all this. Even then, the story was being told in that way. Now, there's also some other insights, I think, particularly in chapter 20. And, Lao Tzu's reiterating a lot of what's gone before. But he has this thing that's interesting. He says, people go looking for fool's gold in auspicious signs. I mean, he's speaking against, like, superstition. He's actually bringing into focus the way we're led by the nose by our desires.
Looking for a good time. I like that.
Looking for a
there.
Good time,
and
you know.
What do most people do? They go looking for a good time.
Yeah.
We haven't really moved on a lot from this time, really, have we?
So, in this sense, what's he drawing our attention to there is what I keep saying, our wish fulfillment fantasies. You know, the idea when we get the red Lambo, that we will be much happier because people will admire us. Because it's empty.
Yeah,
it's all empty, and once you've driven it 120 miles an hour three or four times, where's the next kick coming from?
Yeah.
So there's all that emptiness around acquisitiveness and just consumerism. But at the same time, there is also like the wish for a painless future. You know, this is we're looking for auspicious signs. We're looking for reassurance that it's all going to be okay. We'll read the tarot cards. We'll whatever, or we'll just tell ourselves a story. It's all going to be fine. And Lao Tzu, I would suspect, would say that is precisely how you lose sight of the Tao. Because having sight of the Tao is having an unsullied connection with reality. But yeah, he's bang on about that. This is again what powers consumerism. Is an illusory hope in a painless future. Lao Tzu contrast himself with the acquisitive victim of whatever the the equivalent of our consumerism was in the China of the Warring States 2,500 years ago, thereabouts. And he says of himself, he's lazy and he's unconcerned with fame and money. So again, this is the character of the sage. Even though he's speaking autobiographically here, we understand that he's some kind of sage. And he's saying, well, you'll be better off like this as well. But and he describes himself as a simpleton, really. And I mentioned this before, he's like a child that cannot bring himself to smile. And I would say that this is the absolutely unimpeachable sincerity that the simpleton sage needs to have. And he doesn't smile because it's expected, but he only smiles when it comes from deep inside. Again, he says to himself, he doesn't want anything, he doesn't care, he's unambitious. And even though I've said that this is hyperbole, because, you know, there is a material basis to life, and there's nothing wrong with a moderate prosperity.
No.
There's nothing at all wrong with it. We should be.
I mean, if you get far too precious about that, you just become...
Yeah, well, you give yourself a stick to beat yourself with,
don't
you?
Absolutely, yeah.
But, of course, you need to understand he's being hyperbolic. But there is a serious point underneath this hyperbole. And the point is that immoderate ambition can drive you into a life of inordinate stress.
Yeah.
I mean, he compares himself to a blunted sword, and one who drifts around whichever way he's blown, and he's a bumpkin and all this, and he's never busy. But this is the thing, he's different and strange. Well, why is he different and strange? And well, he explains his eccentricity by saying that he lives for the mother. I mean, what's that mean?
Yes.
I live for the mother.
That's an interesting line.
Remember, like, that the mother is also like it's also the Tao, really. The Tao is seen as a kind of creative matrix, at least in one aspect of the Tao. In as much as we can speak about it, we can say it's a kind of creative matrix. So even though it's the process that's in everything, it is also bigger than that. It's like kind of the matrix out of which it's emerging, in that it has a feminine, motherly, giving birth kind of aspect to its existence. In as much as you can say things like that. So, well, what does it mean, you know, he lives for the mother? Well, he means that only in simplicity and the clarity of simplicity can you align yourself with the Tao. And as I said earlier on, you know, this is a matter of settling, non-doing. It's not cultivation. You can settle into it, nevertheless. You can just allow your eyes to clear, just like allowing water to clear. And then you can come into that simplicity and clarity of simplicity, which is alignment with the Tao. But I will say to this dude, it will place you at odds with the world and his wife. You'll be out of kilter with your house society. I say this to yoga practitioners, you get seriously into this, you'll see through so much of the shit that's around you.
You'll have no friends anymore.
Well, you will. You'll have lots of friends, or maybe, if you want it. But you will be sort of out of kilter with the general bullshit.
Yeah, which but that does happen, you know.
It can happen.
When people get into yoga and they start becoming a little bit more internally quiet, they find they have less and less in common with all their friends.
This can happen, yeah.
And their it's family tough. And their acquaintances and the people at work.
It can be tough.
You know,
it can be tough, and it's an unfortunate mechanism when it gets utilised by cult wallahs, you know.
Yeah.
They can use it for that. So, to round this off now, in this part of the Dao Jing, Lao Tzu is emphasising, you know, that simplicity and the unknowing of that simplicity, in a sense. You know, it's not a sophisticated knowledge or wisdom or cleverness or in any way the result of any kind of cultivation. It's past culture. it's below and above any kind of culture or any kind of cultivation. And nevertheless, earlier on in the Tao Te Ching, he tells us how useful alignment with the Tao is. and how useful a certain quietness is. And actually, how in the clarity of simplicity, because simplicity brings a certain clarity. Simplicity is clear. Yeah. And in the clarity of simplicity, there's also a sensitivity. And all this is mapped out earlier on in the Tao Te Ching. And that sensitivity means that you, in a sense, you pick up information that's not otherwise available. And in these few chapters that we've just looked at, the three chapters we've just looked at, he's talking about some kind of specific noise that robs us of our simplicity and clarity. And one is the pursuit of sophistication and cleverness. And another is the consumerism, the pursuit of things. And another is the way in which we allow our wish fulfillment fantasies to govern our consciousness, and which can draw us into superstition, or into, as I say, just gathering more and more things and status and all the rest of it, in the imagined, but fatal hope that these things will bring us some kind of happiness. So I think that's probably it. What'd you say?
Yeah, I reckon so. Okay, well, I hope you found that interesting and useful, and the wind didn't disrupt the recording too much, hopefully. And we will be back with the next instalment sometime very soon.
And there'll be some other things in between, no doubt.
Oh, I'm sure
there will, things
yeah.
In
there's
the
always
camp.
There's always bits and pieces that we feel inspired to put out there, just almost slightly at random here and a bit spontaneously here and there.
I think there will be an overall coherence by the time. By the time we're so decrepit and ancient.
Yeah, you'll probably when we
can
start
no
going
longer
senile,
do this.
They'll probably notice. Yeah. Oh well, God, maybe they won't.
No.
Maybe we'll sound just the same.
Thanks for listening.